Well, thank you, Kathy, for that introduction, and thank you, Cedar, for having me here today. It's a real pleasure to be here. Now, I know that I'm a replacement for Bill Shorten, so I suppose, in a sense, Ted Baillieu and I both have something in common in that we're both the second option. But I feel secure as a human being, but my fragile ego thanks all of you for actually attending today and not making me feel too bad about it. My brief has been to give you a kind of no-nonsense view of industrial relations reforms from the point of view of workers, employees, with as little rhetoric as possible. That was the specific brief. I'll do my best to conform to that, kind of giving you a no-crap version of it all. I don't absolutely promise to not put in place any rhetoric. That's a difficult ask of somebody like me. Of course, the ancients actually liked rhetoric, and I think it's ultimately the fun part of a speech. So if you do hear a little bit, at least try to enjoy it. I really want to put to you then five propositions that I want you to take away from the speech today, and from there I'll extrapolate a bit beyond the workplace and say why I think these laws actually have an impact on society in our country in a more broad terms. But there are really five propositions that I want to put to you. The first of those is, in a sense, not a proposition, it's actually a question, and that is, what were the motives behind these reforms? Why have we actually seen these industrial reforms happen now? Because I think it is fair to say that the Australian public has never been less involved in such an important piece of legislation. I make that point because this really, without doubt, is the signature reform of this term of government. And yet in the election which gave rise to this term of government, not a word of these policies was ever breathed. Not a word. Which is an extraordinary thing. It's an extraordinary thing when the reforms are of the magnitude that they are. I don't think anyone who is involved in this area has any doubt that the reason why these reforms have happened is because in November of 2004, John Howard woke up and, to his surprise, discovered that he had control of the Senate. And but for that unexpected result, we would not be having these reforms now. In a sense, I actually think that proposition is beyond question. I also think what's beyond question is that the fundamental motive here, I mean, there is rhetoric about productivity and improving international competitiveness of the economy and so forth. I think that anybody who is involved has absolutely no doubt that what this is really about is giving expression to John Howard's long-held ambition to try and deliver a mortal blow to the Australian labour movement in this country. That's really what these are about. And so I guess the first thing that I want to put to you is that I think that the motives for these reforms are highly questionable. And these reforms are in essence fundamentally undemocratic in as much as they were never put before the people at the time that would have mattered in the context of the term of government in which they have been implemented. And that's not something which has been said enough, I think, in this debate. The second proposition then, which in a sense flows from the first, is that from a union point of view, these laws are particularly punitive against trade unions. They are particularly pointed and aimed at trade unions. These laws provide that the simple act of asking an employer to include in an agreement a provision which says that somebody cannot be sacked without first going through a fair process, the simple act of putting that, of asking for that to be put in an agreement, now is against the law and will attract a fine of up to $33,000. And if an employer actually agrees to that clause, well, first of all, the clause will not be valid, but secondly, the employer will be liable to be fined up to $33,000. Now, I'd put to everyone here that in a liberal democracy, a provision of that kind is an absolute outrage. It is an absolute outrage, and it runs completely contrary to the philosophy of the party which is in power at the moment, which is a Liberal Party all about small government, non-intervention, deregulation, letting people get on without the business of government getting involved in them. And yet here is the government engaged in an incredibly interventionist piece of legislation telling us what we cannot agree to. Very punitive, in our view, against unions. The third point is that whilst, in a sense, the attack, I think, has been motivated by a desire to hurt trade unions, really, the real victims in Australia are not so much trade unions or the Labor Party as they are ordinary working people. Ordinary working people who, if they are now employed by an employer with less than 100 people, can be dismissed essentially without cause. Now, what that means is that half the working population in Australia, through that one reform, have had removed from them their right to secure employment. 4 million Australian workers. And that's before you even look at the extent to which the remaining 4 million Australian workers have had their rights to secure employment limited by other reforms in terms of the unfair dismissal legislation. So the real victims are not so much unions as they are ordinary working people. Ordinary working people who are going to see their minimum conditions of employment stripped away as these laws fully gain implementation. So that penalty rates, shift loading, leave loading will no longer form part of the minimum standards of employment in this country. That doesn't really hurt trade unions. It hurts ordinary Australian working people. And ordinary workers who will see, as they surely will, in the coming years, the real value of the minimum wage decline through the workings of the Fair Pay Commission. So the third proposition is that whilst the target might have been unions, in a sense, the real victims have been ordinary working people, and in a sense, I would say they have been the collateral damage in this personal war that John Howard is wanting to wage against trade unions in this country. The fourth point to make is that the laws are not mutual, by which I mean that industrial laws anywhere in the world ought to be establishing a framework of fairness between two parties. Two parties which at times have coincident interests, workers and employers, in seeing the company succeed, but at times have differing interests in terms of how the wealth that is generated by that company is shared throughout the people who are involved in it. A set of industrial laws is really about regulating, mediating, in a sense, those interests. And so mutuality as an essential feature of those laws, you would imagine, should be very prominent. It almost should be sacrosanct. But there is nothing mutual about these laws. There is nothing mutual about them. We now have a situation A union can enter into a collective agreement with an employer for a period, say, of 3 years, which absolutely obliges every worker at that workplace to conform to the terms of those agreements for the period of that time. Now, previously to these laws coming into place, an employer would similarly be compelled to honour the terms of that agreement throughout the life of it. But now, throughout the life of an agreement, an employer can still offer an Australian workplace agreement, which in essence means that the employees are obliged to work to the terms of an agreement, but if the employer wants to alter that agreement in relation to any particular employee, then they are able to do so. And they are able to do so in a way which absolutely affects the interests of people who have no say in that individual agreement. There is nothing mutual about that. The ability to offer individual contracts during the life of a union collective agreement effectively removes any notion of mutuality in the context of that agreement. Another example of it is industrial action. We now have a situation where in order for a union to take lawful industrial action, there are a range of hoops that they need to jump through, which in essence make it almost impossible to take lawful industrial action in pursuit of an agreement. All right, that's fine. But you would imagine that if mutuality was a principle of these laws, that the same thing would apply to an employer. And yet it does not. The artifice here is the requirement of a secret ballot for employees to go through in order to take industrial action. Now, of course, you could say the employer can go through a secret ballot, but that makes no sense because the employer at law is one legal entity, and so a secret ballot doesn't work in that context. What it means is that an employer is completely at liberty to take lawful industrial action, to lock employees out of their workplace, to deny them work, to not pay them wages in order to place pressure upon them to sign an agreement, but unions are effectively prevented from taking that same lawful action in the context of a bargaining dispute. There is nothing mutual about those laws, and as such, they ought to fundamentally undermine them in any fair person's sense about what industrial law should be. What is good for the goose is actually not what is good for the gander under this regime. But the final point that I want to make, and this is the one that I want to spend some time on, is really is a corollary of the other issues, but is so significant on its own that it deserves to be put to you as a separate proposition. And it's this. The cornerstone of our industrial relations system, really, or the various industrial relations systems we've had, really since Federation, has been collective bargaining. Even in the period from 96 through until this year, collective bargaining remained a key pillar, really almost the cornerstone of the industrial relations system. It certainly did up until 1996. What these laws represent is replacing collective bargaining as being the cornerstone of our industrial relations system and instead putting in place the individual contract, the individual relationship between a single worker and their employer. If you were trying to reduce the essence of these laws to one change, that is in essence what they are about. Now, when a single worker tries to negotiate one-on-one with their employer, they do so from a position of weakness. Again, a difficult proposition to argue with. It is the employer who has the right to hire and fire. It is the employer who has the power to direct what the employee does at law. It's the employer who pays the wages. Now, for all these reasons, over the last 150 years, really, workers have banded together through unions to try and maximise their bargaining power and negotiate as a group. That simple idea is at the core of what is now understood to be an international human right, and that is the right to collectively bargain. And that right, in turn, is at the heart of every single industrial relations system of every developed country in the world, every single one. That right is at the core of a range of International Labour Organisation conventions to which Australia is a signatory and therefore the terms of which we are obliged to uphold. Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher did many things in their term of office, but they did not try and challenge that right, but that is absolutely what this legislation is about. That is what John Howard is doing. And by doing that, as I said earlier, what he is putting into place is putting employers in an unprecedented position of power within the workplace. An unprecedented position of power so that now legally they can ask their workers to do more work for less money. And we're already seeing many examples of that happening. And I think in that, John Howard hopes to sweat productivity out of our economy. But I'd put it to you that I don't think that has any possibility of working. That cannot be good for our economy. How do we possibly think that we are going to, as a nation, compete internationally on the basis of low wages? Particularly when our international neighbours are countries like Indonesia, India and China. It will not work. But what it will do is drive the ever-growing gap between the rich and the ordinary in our country. What it will do is give rise in Australia, for the first time, I think, in a meaningful way, to the existence of a working poor. The kind of working poor that you see in the United States of America. And to me, this is the really worst example of this government's mimicking the way things work in America. And if ultimately what we do is import into this country the idea of a working poor, we will be importing here that part of American life which Americans themselves lament. It is not the working poor or the existence of them in America which gives rise to the great productivity of the American economy. That is not why the American economy is so productive. It is productive, I'd put it to you, because of a spirit of enterprise born of the people who strove out into the new world and survived in the harshest of circumstances. And if that sounds familiar, it should, because it's actually a history that we share with the United States. And as such, we already have a spirit of enterprise in this country. We certainly don't need to go out and import one. And to me, that spirit of enterprise ought to be a guiding light along a higher road to achieving productivity in our economy, a road which is based on cooperation and people working together, a road which, in my view, is fundamentally an Australian road. But in a sense, as easy as that is to say, as rhetorical as that is to say, when it comes down to it, cooperating in the workplace is actually, I think, quite a difficult thing to do. It requires employers and employees to sit down and listen to each other. It requires employers to constantly consult with their workforce. It requires compromise, which in turn demands innovation and creative thinking. But when all of this is done, I do believe that cooperation can drive productivity in our economy, not by asking people to do more for less, but by employers involving workers in the running of their business and sharing with them the wealth that is generated by that business, so that workers themselves have as much interest in seeing the success of the business as the employers themselves. It is productivity generated by workers sharing in the wealth that is created by the spirit of enterprise and thus contributing to the productivity of an enterprise. And I'd argue that that's the Australian way. And that's the way that Australian unions have advocated for now for more than a century. But by contrast, these laws are going to give rise to exploitation. They already are. From the meat workers at Cowra to the spotless workers at Puckapunyal to school teachers at Newington College in Sydney, all of them are, to a greater or lesser degree, experiencing exploitation at the hands of this legislation. And you see, once one company goes down the path of using these laws to their full extent and using them in an exploitative way, they create a pressure for every other company to walk down that path with them so that a competitive edge is not gained. And I would put to you that by contrast with cooperation, exploitation is actually a very easy thing for an employer to do, a very easy thing. It eschews consultation. It indulges employers to be narrow-minded, dull and lazy. And it fundamentally disenfranchises working people from sharing in the wealth that is generated by a market economy in a free society. But that is the path that John Howard is taking us down, and that is the path that these laws are taking us down. Which then leads me to say this in more general terms about our society. I think if, as a country, we go down that path, then we will have lost our way. We will have lost our way because it wasn't so many years ago that Australia actually was the fairest society on the planet. In 1970, the gap between rich and poor in Australia was closer than any other country in the world, any other country. And I think that that relative financial equality actually underpinned a whole lot of cultural values which at one level we take for granted, but which we also hold dear. Cultural values like fairness and egalitarianism, and a cultural value which the Prime Minister is very fond of, which Henry Lawson first identified, of mateship, which John Howard thought to be such an important principle that it ought to be contained in the preamble to our Constitution. Well, you don't have mateship if you have a piece of legislation which at its essence is about allowing one Australian to exploit another. And you don't have these grand cultural values if you sweep away the economic underpinning of them. And that is exactly what these laws will do. In our view, they represent this government's fundamental abandonment of the Australian spirit of cooperation. But I don't think that it is just Australian working people who are experiencing this government's abandonment of the spirit of cooperation. I think other Australians in differing circumstances are experiencing it all the time. I think Muslim Australians are experiencing it. Muslim Australians who are feeling the prejudice which has been whipped up against them by this government. I think Indigenous Australians experience it when they stare disbelievingly at our national parliament and its inability to say sorry to them. And I think refugees have experienced it. Refugees who have come to this country seeing Australia as a beacon of hope in the world, but on arrival here have been met by the very worst example of how mean the human spirit can be. I mean, this is John Howard's Australia, but it's certainly not the Australia I know, and I don't think it's the Australia that any of us would be proud of. That is not the point that I want to end the speech on, because in a sense it's too depressing. There is, at least from a union point of view, from a workers' point of view, a more uplifting note at which I want to end. And it's this. I do think that in these laws and in these reforms, John Howard has overplayed his hand. He has unquestionably, in a sense, I think, put Labor right back into the hunt in terms of the next federal election, which at one level is a remarkable comment to say, to make, given how appalling, from a Labor point of view, the result of the last federal election was. But there is no doubt, all the polling is saying this, that this issue is completely toxic out there for the government, and there is no doubt that Labor is absolutely in the hunt to win the next federal election. So clearly from our, you know, we'd prefer these laws don't happen, but clearly from our point of view there is a definite upside in relation to that. And in a sense, from a union point of view, since May of last year, when these reforms were first announced, we have seen people joining the trade union movement in unprecedented numbers. an amazing result, really, and ironic, because as I said at the start, I think the whole point of this initially was to try and hurt trade unions in this country, but I think these laws, or perhaps more accurately, Australia's response to them, has actually given the union movement a real shot in the arm. I also think these laws are going to place the question squarely before corporate Australia. Is corporate Australia about working with their people, or are they about exploiting them? Is corporate Australia about a spirit of cooperation, or is it about division and fear? No doubt in the months and years to come, we will see the answers to these questions become apparent. But I don't think we're going to find the answers to those questions in the workings of the John Howard government. On the other hand, I do think that if we look to those values which make us special as a people, which we do hold dear, values of fairness and egalitarianism and, yes, even mateship, the values that the world used to know us for, I think if we look to those values, then I do believe that the campaign that's currently being run at the moment, that the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Australians who have already taken to the streets in protest against these laws, that with the help of all of these people, and particularly in the lead up to the 2007 election, I do believe that these may well become the values that the world knows us for once again. Thank you for having me here today.